From WYPR, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. From the shape of the nests birds build to the color of their feathers, technology is turning theories dating back to Darwin on their head. Biologist Jordan Price of St. Mary's College of Maryland has mapped the genes of both ancient and more recently derived bird species. He tells us why domed bird nests evolved into the widespread bowl shape, why the color of feathers might be more about camouflage than attraction, and what scientists got wrong when studying the differences between female and male birds. Price says that when researchers map female song onto the genetic family tree of birds,
the ancestor just comes out as having female song, singing very much like males. So female song has been lost just multiple times.
The evolution of birds, on the record, after the news.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at wypr.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@wypr.org.
Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. Picture a bird's nest. What do you see? Probably something that looks like a cup or a bowl, round and uncovered. This style of nest is very common among the largest order of birds, passerines, which make up more than half of all bird species. But bird species with ancient lineages, such as lyrebirds and scrubbirds, both found in Australia, build domed nests, more complex, covered structures. Until recently, biologists theorized that nest shape evolved from bowl to dome. Now that theory has been turned on its head. Joining me to talk about birds and how they and their nests have evolved is Jordan Price, an evolutionary biologist who is the Stephen Muller Distinguished Professor of the Sciences at St. Mary's College of Maryland. Welcome to On the Record.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So first, what can biologists learn from birds' nests?
You know, birds are architects. They build these complex structures, and by studying their designs, we can, you know, learn something about how complex behaviors evolve, because they really kind of reflect the underlying kind of behavioral programs and genetic programs that, you know, were involved in building the nests.
So if a bird is building a nest with a roof or a nest without a roof, that says something about the overall evolution of that bird?
Well, it says something about its behavior. I think we often make an assumption that behavioral, you know, sequences, complex behaviors evolve cumulatively from, you know, simple behaviors to more complex behavioral sequences. And so that's probably partly underlying why we've often had this assumption that nests evolved from simple forms to more complex forms.
Well, you went to Australia to study the nests of birds with ancient lineages. First of all, how do biologists know that these bird species, lyrebirds, scrubbirds, are more ancient?
Well, yeah, I went to Australia. I worked with a great guy over there named Simon Griffith at Macquarie University. And so we use molecular phylogenies. We use these phylogenetic trees to kind of reconstruct the past.
I don't know what a phylogenetic tree is.
So it's, you know, a tree of relationships. It's a lot like a family tree, like a genealogy.
Oh.
You are most closely related to your sibling, you know, through your parents, and you're a bit more distantly related to a cousin, you know, through your grandparents and a second cousin and so on. And we can do the same thing with species and kind of use that tree to figure out what might have happened in the past. So I guess the early 2000s, like 2002, 2004, scientists began to realize that the really ancient relationships were on the Australian continent, kind of like the really ancient, you know, human relationships are in Africa, at least with the passerines, with the largest group of birds. These passerine birds had really radiated out of Australia. So that's kind of the epicenter of passerine evolution there.
Tell me about passerines. What kind of birds are passerines?
So they're mostly the songbirds. So most of the birds that you see, most of the birds, certainly the birds you hear singing, are passerines. Passerines are about 60% of birds. You know, of the 10,000 or so species of birds on the planet. There are about 6,000 are passerines, and about 5,000 of those are songbirds. You know, include like finches and warblers and sparrows, jays, crows. They're a really, really successful group, and of course have really diverse nests.
This is On the Record on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cass speaking with biologist Jordan Price of St. Mary's College of Maryland about the evolution of birds and birds' nests. So the birds that you looked at in Australia, what did the birds and their nests look like?
The birds in Australia are incredible. I mean, one thing that was kind of interesting that surprised us was that of the passerines, about three-quarters of them, about 72% of passerine families have cup nests, these open cups. So these more elaborate domed structures that some species build are rarer. But when you go to Australia, it's more like a third of the species there have covered nests like that. So they're a bit more common. Some people may have heard of lyrebirds. They're the, like really good mimics. I think there was a thing on the internet where a lyrebird is imitating a chainsaw or something. They're pretty amazing for that. But their nests are very cool, too. They're these big domed structures that they build kind of close to the ground. Males have these really elaborate tails that actually look like the instrument. I've never actually seen a scrub bird. They're not very common.
So I'm having a really hard time getting my head around the idea that there could have been species of birds that built these complex structures with domes and then simplified it. Why do you think that happened? I mean, what is the evidence that that happened? And if it did happen, why?
Well, let me talk about the evidence first. Because it's a little bit difficult to explain kind of how you use a phylogeny to reconstruct evolutionary history. But the analogy I like to use is, like, say you're visiting some village and there are, you know, siblings there, say two sisters that are weaving baskets, and it's some family tradition that they have. And the weaver family, I don't know. And and one of them, you know, weaves a different basket than the other one. Like maybe it, you know, weaves it with a roof on it or something. And you're wondering, like, is this, like, which is the family tradition and which is the one, which is the innovation, which is the one that's kind of derived and which is, I guess, the relatively ancestral one. And you could go to the next village and maybe there's a cousin there that you know, makes baskets that are open without the roof. And you're like, okay, well, and you go to another village and there's a more distant relative that has that same form, and that you can accumulate more and more evidence that, you know, that open basket design was probably the ancestral form, and that one with the roof was the one that the one sister developed. And so we can kind of do that with phylogenies, like look at relationships and kind of map these traits onto it to try to figure out, you know, what the family tradition was, what these traits were in the ancient past going back. So when we map nest design onto the phylogenetic tree of the passerines, it really strongly shows that the ancestral nest was one, this kind of elaborate structure with a dome, and that these more simple open cups had evolved multiple times from that. And interestingly, this happened in Australia. So you have at least four times in birds called honey eaters and in birds called bowerbirds, and this really large group of birds called the Passerida that radiated, you know, that includes about 3,000 to 4,000 species. These open cup nests evolved, you know, independently in those, and also in these South American birds. So yeah, that's kind of the evidence. We can kind of calculate the probability of what the ancestor was like. But why it occurred is was that your other question?
Right. And before I press you on that, where did you find the nests that you looked at?
There is so much information online now. There are these, there's so much collected wisdom at this point from field guides and from ornithologists all over the world. There's a great database of sorts called the Handbook of Birds of the World, and it's online, and you can just access information for, you know, thousands and thousands of species. I also went to a museum there in Australia and got to go out and actually see some of the actual nests too.
These conclusions you're reaching are not just based on what you find in Australia, which leads us back to the question, why would this have happened?
For one thing, the open cups are easier to build in many cases. They're more easily replaced.
So it's kind of an efficiency argument?
It could be, yeah. We think that these changes occurred maybe around 40, 45 million years ago on the Australian continent. This was a time when the climate was really changing there. You know, maybe that had something to do with it. It could be that the species community was changing. Maybe there were new predators. It's hard to really answer why questions looking back in the past like that.
Well, you used a phrase a minute ago and kind of went right on. You said this change had evolved multiple times. So it wasn't like a trend among birds to move from complexity to a more simple shape. Evolutionary choice got played out multiple times, multiple places?
Multiple times in different lineages. So in different groups of birds, when you look at this passerine phylogenetic tree, there are branches where this occurred. And now we have these large, very speciose groups that now have open cups. So one thing that is totally possible is that this change from domed to cup was one of the innovations that may have played a role in the evolutionary diversification of these birds. It really seems that the groups that evolved these open cups tend to be larger than the groups that didn't have that change. And again, it occurred in Australia, but it immediately preceded, at least in one case, this diversification out into the rest of the world and may have been something that was a real innovation that allowed these birds to really kind of take off and eventually become 60% of all birds.
And so maybe the question I should have been asking is, why didn't all the birds make that change?
Yeah, that's a good question. There are some benefits to having a dome, I think. You know, you have greater concealment from predators. There's work that my colleague Simon Griffiths is doing in Australia showing that maybe domes are really good kind of insulators for eggs, not to keep them warm, but actually to keep them cool out in the desert. So some species, it may really pay to have a roof. It's just more costly.
I'm still having a hard time picturing how you can know what a bird looked like or sounded like generations ago from examining the DNA.
Once you know the relationships among things and you know the diversity, like what organisms have what traits, like what species have what traits, you can figure out kind of statistically like what are the most likely traits that existed in the past. We can use a method called parsimony, which is this idea that the simplest explanation for evolutionary history is probably the correct one. And so if you looked at, say, a bat and a bird and a mouse, and you're trying to figure out relationships among these things, you could group the bird and the bat together based on the fact that they both have flight. But if you did that, there are all these other traits that would have to have changed kind of independently in the bat and in the mouse, having teeth, having hair, producing milk, you know, all these traits. So we say it's not a very parsimonious phylogeny. If we group the bat and the mouse together and say, okay, maybe flight evolved independently twice, then all these other traits evolve only once, teeth, hair, milk production, all kinds of things like that. So one is a simpler explanation than the other. So that's how we construct these trees, and then in turn, how we use the trees to figure out like what is the most likely explanation for what's happened in the past with these traits, like birds' nests or things like that.
Do you scientists have new tools to apply to this study?
What we understand about relationships in birds has been constantly changing, you know, over the decades, and that's largely due to new abilities to sequence DNA to construct relationships among species. And you know, we're using more and more genes and larger regions of the genome, and indeed starting to use entire genomes to figure out relationships among species, and also better statistical tools for trying to do that.
That is evolutionary biologist Jordan Price of St. Mary's College of Maryland here on The Record. I'm Sheila Cast. We're going to take a quick break now on WIPR, and when we come back, we'll address what I think many of you listeners are really waiting for, drab, quiet females and flashy, loud males. We'll talk about the assumptions about the differences between female and male birds. This is On The Record. I'm Sheila Cast. Stay with us.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. If you're outdoors on a beautiful spring day, you might stop to enjoy the sounds of birds chirping and singing. Maybe you can even spot a bright red cardinal or a striking black and orange oriole. We're talking today about the evolution of birds and what new research says about the differences between males and females. My guest is Jordan Price, an evolutionary biologist who is the Stephen Muller Distinguished Professor of the Sciences at St. Mary's College of Maryland. The idea that male birds sing in order to attract a mate, where does this theory come from?
Well, it goes back to Darwin. This was one of the inspirations, I guess, for Darwin's idea of sexual selection, the idea that there are traits that evolve purely because they increase reproductive success. So a male can have a trait that he can use to compete with other males and to attract females. And that trait can be favored because it leads to higher reproductive success for those males.
And so were you essentially testing that hypothesis when you conducted a study of New World blackbirds, that category, more than 100 species of birds found in North and South America?
Kind of like the study with the nests, we were, again, like reconstructing what's happened in the past. So there's a lot of focus on why male birds sing and why male birds have, you know, such bright colors. You know, when you go out and you hear birds singing, it is often the males, and almost always actually up here in temperate zones. And females are more quiet and more dull colored. Again, a lot of focus has been on why males have these traits. And so we wanted to see basically what's happened in the past and reconstruct these changes in color and changes in song. And we found this really surprising result. For song, just to begin with, it's not that males have gained song in the evolutionary past, it's that females have lost it.
How do you know that?
Again, by mapping these traits onto the phylogeny. And up here in temperate zones in North America, males generally sing and females don't. But if you go to the tropics, it's often the case that females sing like males. And in many cases, they actually sing really complex duets. And it turns out that when you look at these birds, like the geography of when you kind of map geographic location onto these things, you find that many of the ancestors were tropical. So they have kind of evolved kind of out of the tropics. And when we map song, male and female song onto the tree, like all males sing, but when we map female song onto the tree, we find that the ancestor just comes out as having female song, singing very much like males. So female song has been lost just multiple times in this family, at least 11 or 12 times on different lineages.
Why would females have lost the ability to sing?
It's a great question. There's some ideas that it could have something to do with maybe parental care. There's some evidence that in species where females sing near the nest more than in others, they experience higher predation rates.
Let me make sure I understand that. So if a female bird who's watching over the eggs belts out a song that attracts a predator. The eggs get eaten. There's no evolution there.
That's exactly right. Evolutionary dead end. So it could be that if females are spending more time near the nest than males, maybe it actually pays for the female to be quieter, to be more cryptically colored, things like that.
That's evolutionary biologist Jordan Price here on The Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about the differences between male and female birds and how they've changed over eons. Most of us have been told that male birds are more colorful because it helps them attract a mate. So in terms of their coloring, what did you learn?
Something very similar to what we found with song, but a little bit more complex. The story's a little bit more complicated, I think. We found that, at least in the blackbirds, that in the ancestors, females looked a lot like males. They had very similar colors, and females repeatedly in different lineages of the family have evolved, have lost, you know, these male colors and taken on these more cryptic brown striped colors. That if you've ever seen a red-winged blackbird, the female looks completely different from the male. She's smaller and she has dull brown color, very difficult to see in the marsh. And so that evolved over and over again. But what's really interesting is that in many cases, females have evolved back to the male color again. So when we actually, we did something that we weren't able to do with song. We were able to go in and look at and try to calculate the evolutionary rates, like how rapidly things had changed in color in males and in females independently. And we found that males, you know, male colors have kind of evolved steadily all the way along, but female colors have evolved much more rapidly, and they've evolved kind of, you know, away from the male pattern into this kind of typical cryptic female pattern, and then back to the males and back and forth. And when we actually calculated average rates, we found that more rapid and more frequent changes occurred in females than in males, which was really surprising, because there is so much focus on the evolution of male traits. There are entire books written on why male red-winged blackbirds sing the way they do and have the colors that they do and have those cool red epaulettes on their wings and things like that. But there's been very little focus on what's gone on in females, but most of the changes have occurred in females.
Is it aimed at procreation, or is it aimed at self-protection, or is it, I mean, is there some challenge that the female of the species is facing that's different than just getting into the next generation?
I think that's the most important thing, is the next generation for both sexes. So I think what's going on with some of these things that a bunch of us are finding, scientists all over the world are finding this stuff, that the story of how these sexually selected traits have evolved, things like colors and songs and things like that, it's much more complicated than Darwin envisaged, I think. We often think that if males and females are really different in some traits, we call that a dimorphism. If they're really dimorphic, that must mean that sexual selection is really strongly working on those traits. But what we were finding with colors in these birds is that, yes, sexual selection is targeting male traits. Like male colors and songs are certainly used for attracting females and for competing with males and stuff like that. But in many species, they're also used by females. In other species, they're not. It really depends on what the selection pressures are, like how natural selection has worked on females. And if natural selection and sexual selection, if these selection pressures work on the sexes differently, then the sexes will be different. And if there's no reason for males and females to be different, then they won't be. And so just, you know, how dimorphic things are in their songs or in their colors or whatever doesn't necessarily indicate, it's not purely caused by this idea that Darwin had of sexual selection. There's a lot more going on.
Well, you say that there has been much more evolutionary change in females than in males. Why are researchers only now discovering that?
I think because when you look at females across these birds, actually, when you look at, for example, the orioles, Most of the differences between the sexes are in males. When you look at the females, they're really hard to tell apart, actually.
Females of different species are difficult to tell apart.
Right, of different species. You know, male traits have kind of evolved steadily in this really directional way, whereas females have evolved really rapidly in all sorts of different directions. But in the end, this kind of dull female coloration that's really useful for hiding near the nest has evolved repeatedly over and over again. You see females in South America that look just like females up here of female red-winged blackbirds. We call it convergent evolution, has evolved over and over and over again.
I'm trying not to be anthropomorphic about this, but do you see any lesson in changes in achievements by females being overlooked?
Yeah, I think that there has been a real bias in looking mostly at males. I mean, it's a little bit understandable because males are so colorful and so conspicuous, you know, in their song and all these other really cool traits. But yeah, part of it may just be, you know, I don't know, just a sexual bias. I mean, we've also been biased, actually, in focusing on North American species and European species and have largely ignored a lot of the really interesting stuff that happens down in tropical species.
I really appreciate your giving us some insight into your work. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Jordan Price is an evolutionary biologist, a professor of biology, and the Stephen Muller Distinguished Professor of the Sciences at St. Mary's College of Maryland. This is On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. Thanks for listening. Be back with us again tomorrow.